I want to talk this morning about the subject of humanism. Humanism. Now, you can speak for hours and hours and hours on humanism, but we want to get at the basic philosophical problem behind humanism, and that is the finiteness of man and of man's mind. Just a little bit of a review concerning last night, very, very brief. We discussed the idea of naturalism, which says that the universe is only natural causes in a completely closed system. There is no supernatural that can intervene into the natural system. That's the way the naturalist looks at the universe. And most of the people that you talk to on the streets are going to look at the universe in that way. And then there's supernaturalism. Are you folks over there able to see now? Because this was, you couldn't see before. Able to see? You see, Phil? Okay. And then supernaturalism, which says that the supernatural can operate into the natural and can reorder it, restructure it, suspend it, or whatever. So that things like the parting of the Red Sea can actually take place because the supernatural can reorder, restructure the natural causes that are going on in the universe. So as it says, water stood up as walls on either side of the people. Well, it did. See? That's what happened. That's contrary to natural law. And some people say, well, it does say in the Bible that a strong wind, east wind, blew all night and parted the seas. Well, if you had water blowing strongly enough, that it could make water stand up on end like that, how did the people walk against that? You ever tried to walk in a strong wind? Well, try to walk in a wind that's strong enough to make a sea stand up on end. It's going to be a bit difficult. So there had to be something supernatural about it. It couldn't have just been the wind. It says the strong east wind blew to dry out the ground that they were going to go over on. It wasn't to make the water stand up on end. See? Okay, so we have naturalism and supernaturalism, and we want to look at this morning at humanism, which is just, to use excuse the expression, a natural result of the thinking of naturalism. That is, if you start with the idea that the universe is natural causes in a completely closed system, then you only have the finite mind of man to try to figure out what's going on in the universe. Since there is no supernatural, you have no possibility of revelation from a mind like the mind of God. And so the humanist is left with only his finite mind, and humanism is sometimes also called rationalism. Man is left with only his finite mind to figure out what is going on in his life and in the universe. Now, I'll give you a little bit of background about humanism. The word humanist or humanism was originally a Christian word. It was Christian in content, and it meant a person who was concerned about the significance and the abilities of the human being. A person who is concerned about man. And so originally, coming out of the ideas from the Bible that man is made in the image of God, humanism was the idea that man is significant and man can do significant things. See, now this happened around the end of the Renaissance, and when the word was coined, and the emphasis through the Middle Ages, by the way, the Middle Ages should be called the Middle Ages. They are called the Dark Ages by humanists because the only thing that was ruling at that time was Christianity. Because the church was in rule at that time, the Middle Ages are called the Dark Ages by humanists. That's where we get the term the Dark Ages. See, they weren't really dark. They're called that by humanists because of their prejudice against the church. You know where that term came from? So we refer to them as the Middle Ages when the church was basically in rule. But the church did have some problems with emphasizing the supernatural and de-emphasizing the natural. And you notice in their art, in many cases, there were very small human figures. And then anything that had to do with the supernatural, like Jesus or Mary or angels, were just huge. See? And so they emphasized, even in their artwork, the supernatural above the natural. And then during the Renaissance, there began to be a shift over towards emphasizing nature and saying, yeah, nature's okay. God made nature too. See? And so the human being is okay. He doesn't have to be de-emphasized in order to glorify God. As a matter of fact, emphasizing man and his significance does glorify God because God made man and he made him to be this way and to be significant. So when people began to emphasize the significance of man, the word humanism was applied to a person, or a humanist, was a person who emphasized the significance of man. But at first, that was a Christian idea. man was significant because he was made in the image of God. And then towards the end of the Renaissance, right at the very end of that time, moving into another period of process philosophy, but towards the end, people made a shift in their thinking, in their presupposition, away from the biblical idea of God in the universe towards naturalism. And then because there was a shift in the presupposition towards naturalism, there of necessity was a difference, a change in the definition of the word humanist. See? Because the human being then was no longer significant because he was made in the image of God. It was simply the human being is significant, and then man began to take the place of God. Man was made the center of the universe rather than God. You understand the difference? And so when people began to look at man as the center of the universe and naturalism as the way things are, everything is natural causes in a closed system, then what happened was the word humanist changed its definition. But it happened very slowly and very subtly. Okay? And so you still even have people today who think that the word humanist means, they get it confused with all kinds of things. They get it confused with humanities, which is the study of history. You see? Humanities is not humanism, and humanism is not humanities. And they get it confused with humanitarian, you see? Or even they get it confused with human. And there's a big difference between humanitarian, which means to be good, see? There's a difference between being humanitarian and being a humanist, because you can be a humanitarian and be a Christian. See? Christians should be humanitarians. They should be concerned about human beings and human rights, see? But to be a humanist means to have man at the center of the universe and not God, and that man's mind is the only thing that you have to try to figure out what's going on in the universe. So what happened was the shift occurred in people's thinking, in their presupposition, from supernaturalism to naturalism, and the word humanist had to change definitions. And that's why a lot of people today still think the idea of humanist is good, and they don't realize that basically a humanist is a person who does not believe in God and believes that man is the center of the universe, and that man is basically good, okay? Which is backwards to what Christianity says. It says that God is the center of the universe, man was made by God, and man has fallen away from God, and man is basically evil. Okay, so that occurred around the end of the Renaissance. And so rationalism, or atheistic humanism, as it is sometimes called, developed. Humanism, atheistic humanism, that is the idea that there is no God, so man is the center. Atheistic humanism is also sometimes called rationalism because man starts with only his finite mind to try to figure out what's going on in the universe. If you have natural causes in a completely closed system, there is no other alternative except rationalism or humanism. There's no alternative because there is no possibility of revelation from a mind like the mind of God, because no God exists. See? All there is the natural and the natural causes. Okay, so then humanism basically now is an atheistic system. If you read the Humanist Manifesto, you'll be quite shocked at how blatant it is. You know? We reject a Christian idea of morals because we feel it is restricting to our freedom, and we feel that we should have sexual freedom, and so we don't want to submit to things that say things like you shall not commit adultery or not committing fornication. They very blatantly, you know, say people should be able to determine their own morals and there should be no God telling them what to do. So it's very, very blatant. You should get a copy if you can sometime and read the Humanist Manifesto. Okay? It's not very long. It's not hard to read. You can get a copy and read it sometime and it will shock you that they're actually saying that. Okay. And then we want to go on and talk about how man tries to find his meaning in life. How does man try to find his meaning in life? Whether you're a humanist, naturalist, existentialist, Christian, whatever, you will search for where your meaning in life comes from. You can see that all the time when you go out witnessing. People are looking for, where does my meaning in life come from? What is my meaning? And they look in all kinds of activities, all kinds of things, trying to find their meaning in life. And man goes through a particular process of trying to find his meaning in life, and we want to look at that process. Here is a little man from about 12 feet up, Okay? Little man from the top. And this is my symbol for a little man. Sometimes I use it for God, but make it a little bigger. This symbol for man is a little man. We'll say that he's a philosophy professor at a local university. Okay? So he's thinking. And this guy has different things in his life. And these different things, which can be either concrete or abstract, things like the dog that he has at home and the three puppies that it's just had, okay, cute, and the his wife, one of the particulars in his life, his daily newspaper, the people that he teaches in school, the professors that he deals with in school, his knowledge of philosophy, his knowledge of anthropology, his knowledge of mathematics. See, these are all units of knowledge or things, particulars in his life that he has to deal with. And in order to understand his meaning in life, he really needs to understand his relationship to all of these different areas of knowledge. Okay? We'll go through this a number of different ways so that you'll begin to... I always say things five different ways so you can get it. Okay? This guy has a relationship with different things, and that in philosophy is called the particulars. Everything in the universe, every individual thing in philosophy is called a particular. My Bible is a particular, I am a particular, piece of chalk is a particular, the blackboard is a particular, you are a particular, right? The chair you're sitting on is a particular. Those are all particulars, and in order for the man to understand his place and his meaning in the universe, he has to understand his relationship to the particulars that are around him. How does he relate? How does he compare? What are the similarities? What are the differences between himself and the things around him? You can see where something like Eastern religions, which says that everything is God, can be very threatening to a person's identity. Because if you are God, and a tree is God, and a mouse is God, and a rock is God, you see what that does to your sense of significance? You're really no more significant than the rock, because the rock is God, and you are God. And if you think that you're more significant than the rock, you're deluded. You're suffering behind an illusion, behind the veil of Maya. Okay? So if you think that you're more important, you're just deluded. And you have to overcome that illusion and come to the conclusion that you are not more important than the rock. We'll talk about that under Eastern religions. But you see, because the man in Eastern religions would not be able to understand his difference, or he knows his similarity, but he would not know his difference from the things around him, there would be no difference, then he can have no more significance than the things around him. See? That is why, in places like India, the things that are, everything is considered God, but things that are impersonal are not brought to the level of God, but everything is lowered to the level of the impersonal. See? And people are treated like rocks. Just look at the history of India, and you'll see that's true. So this man must figure out what his relationship is with these different things around him. Now this poor man does not know that revelation has been brought from the mind of God, specific revelation to him. He may know that something out there indicates there's a God, like in nature or something. But he doesn't know that there's a specific revelation, like the Bible, from the mind of God. And so he, with his own mind, must try to construct a universal concept, a universal concept which will help him to understand the relationship between that thing and that thing and those things and himself. And so this universal concept, which we're looking from the top now, would be sort of a covering. I always erase these when I do this, to draw them back in again. Okay. Looking from the top, it's like an umbrella. And these particulars, then, if the man can find a universal concept that is related to this particular and that particular and himself, then he'll have a concept that helps him to understand how he's related to those particular things in his life or in the universe. Okay? Now, we're going to take this picture and turn it on its side and talk about the process that the man goes through to try to find that universal concept. Okay, here is the man. We've turned him on his side now. There is the man. And what he is going to do is he is going to try to find a universal concept that will help him to understand all of the different things in the universe and how they relate to him and how he relates to them. Right? That's what he's trying to do. Now, there's a process that he will go through, and we want to talk about that process. It's a thought process that he'll go through, and you need to understand it. Let us say that there is, now try to imagine this, there is a cow standing right here. This happens to be a black and white spotted cow. Has a bell around its neck from Switzerland. Most of the cows in Switzerland are brown, so we've got a black and white cow, we'll have to just have the bell from Switzerland. Okay, black and white spotted cow, and let's give the cow a name. Bessie. Okay, good cow name. Better than George for cows. Okay. This cow is named Bessie. Very specific, this cow. There's only one cow like this in the whole world. There may be more cows that are named Bessie, but there's only one cow like this that's named Bessie. Now, there are particular spots that are a particular shape on the cow, and the way that I can get you to most nearly experience what I experience when I look at Bessie, or smell Bessie, or, you know, feel Bessie, or I won't go into any other things, hear Bessie, okay, is to point at Bessie. Okay? The way to get you to most nearly experience what I do when I've got this guitar is to go like this. You see? Notice the broken string? Sure you notice that? Okay? That is the way you will most nearly experience that. That is what is called the highest level of concreteness. Now, you know the difference between concrete and abstract? Okay? Something that is concrete is tangible. We would normally think of it as a physical thing. However, there are certain spiritual things that are concrete, like a demon is a concrete entity, actually exists as an entity, has stuff to it, even though that stuff is spiritual and we don't usually see it. However, the being is a concrete being. But there are other things that are abstract, such as the idea of justice. Justice does not exist as an actual entity having some stuff to it. Justice is an abstract noun. See? A spirit, a demon, is a concrete noun, even though that to us seems like it's not as, it seems like it's not as real because it's not physical. Okay? But they are just as real, and they are concrete entities. You got the idea? Bessie now, here, standing here, is a concrete entity, and when I point at Bessie, you will most nearly experience what I experience when we point at Bessie. That's the highest level of concreteness. You experience the most concrete details, and the lowest level of abstraction. It is not abstract, it is very concrete. Now we're going to remove Bessie. Erase Bessie. Okay, Bessie's gone. And we are going to make a big jump, and we're going to refer to that cow as Bessie. We have now made a very, very big jump from the concrete to the abstract. We have used a symbol to represent something that is concrete. We've used the word Bessie and the sounds Bessie to communicate something to you. So when you think Bessie, there may be more cows than one named Bessie. But in this case, we're going to still limit it to that's the one cow that we're talking about, named Bessie. However, we have left many concrete aspects out. When we talk about Bessie, we might not all think about the particular black and white spots, the kind of bell that she wears, or where she lives. See? We just think of the cow, Bessie, just abstractly. We've left a lot of concrete things out. So we've gone to a lower level of concreteness, higher level of abstraction. See? Now we're going to make another jump. Cow. Now, is Bessie a cow? Is this that was right here a cow that was there? Okay? Because that's Bessie. And so we've taken another jump, and we've left many of the concrete aspects out, and we've made a jump to another category, which is more abstract, less concrete. We leave more and more concrete details and become have greater and greater abstraction, greater and greater level of abstraction. And now, how many cows are involved under this? How many animals are involved there? Lots of animals under the idea of a cow. And the larger the category becomes, the more abstract it becomes, then the more things that are included under it. Every time you make a jump in a level of abstraction, more things are included under it. You understand? And so when a man is trying to find the category that covers everything, what he is doing is trying to go up the level of abstraction until he reaches an infinite category that will cover everything in the universe that is now or ever will be or has been. Okay? He has to go up the level of abstraction until he finds an infinite category that covers everything that is or ever will be or has been so that he can understand the relationships between the things. Now, we're going to take a closer look at this. Oh, by the way, you can go up farther. After cow, you can say farm animal, then you can go animal, then you can go living thing, which would involve plant, see, as well. You can go up past that and go thing, and then you can go, see? You can go into all kinds of levels of abstraction there. Now, here is this this man, and there are other men, and we have the category, man, or mankind, okay? You've got individual men, and then you've got the category mankind, which is an abstraction. When we think of mankind, we think of female human beings, male human beings, and all different kinds of men. Okay? We'll include all the different individual human beings on the earth, mankind. Okay? Now, over here, we have cows. Okay? And then we have over here chicken, right? And then we've got some wild rabbits here. Now, the only problem with that is that you usually, you know, have trouble keeping track of the rabbits. You heard about the little boy who walked into his dad. His dad was milking a cow in the barn, and he's got this rabbit by the ears. And his dad walks. He walks up to his dad, and his dad goes, "I wonder what this is." His son stands there and he goes, 2 plus 2, 8 plus 9, 3 plus 1. See? And his father says, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I heard that rabbits could multiply, and this one can't even add." See? So, there are chickens and rabbits, or mice, or whatever you want, okay, not to be confused with the men over here. And then we have other categories, such as farm animals. These are wild rabbits. They're not farm rabbits, okay? And then we've got wild animals. There may be some other kinds of animals over here, okay? We've got wild animals. And then we've got, over here, we've got animals that are moral beings. The Bible calls us a nephesh, uses the same word as it does for the cows. Man became a living nephesh, and the cows are called nephesh too, okay? So here is an animal that God has made that happens to be quite different because he is made in the image of God and the other animals are not. We're different in the way of spiritual capacities, intellect, emotions, will, so forth. And then there can be a category here of animal. Or you could put these two together like this and say non-moral animals. And then you can include that with the other animals that are also moral. Then you can have plants over here. Right. You can have plants over here. Different kinds of things like that. Other categories. It goes up to things. Say, going into impersonal objects. You can go up the level of abstraction. Now, the way that you understand, you notice that these become less and less concrete as you go up. You've got individual chickens, but they're also, they fit under the category of farm animals, but there are all kinds of animals that fit under that category. So you've left out the concrete details of the chickens, moved up to a higher level of abstraction, and thus included many objects under that category. Still following me? Okay, and then as you go up the levels of abstraction, it helps you to understand if you can go up the levels of abstraction to where you have found a category that covers both you and another thing, and you go down the levels of abstraction to the concrete detail. This happens in your mind. It happens automatically, really, that when you do that, when you go, a man is an animal, is a living thing, has that in common with other living things named plants, and there are these particular kinds of plants, and you realize how you are related and how you are different because of the categories up here. Okay? You go up the levels of abstraction, then you go down the levels of abstraction. Now, when you don't have categories for something, it is very, in your mind, it is very difficult to understand them. It is also very easy to become afraid of something for which you have no categories in your mind. I'll give you an example. Let's say that the door were to open right now, and this strange purple furry-looking thing, you couldn't tell what was its head, whether it even had a head, came floating in about 6 inches off the floor. And you saw this thing, and it was making some very strange sounds that you could not interpret as being intelligent or not. What would you do? Well, I'd probably rebuke it. The first thing I'd do as responding as a Christian. But who knows? This may be another kind of rational being that God has made that lives somewhere else in the universe. Who knows what this thing is? See? But the reason that we would probably first off be afraid is because we don't have any categories in our mind to which to relate it. The only, as Christians, we're not completely lost, though, because we do know that everything that has been made by God. So we know it's a creation of God, but the question is, what kind of creation is it? What is it, rational or is it non-rational? You know, should I jump up on the chair and hope that it can't come any higher? Or should I try to communicate with it? See? Find out what it knows about God. You don't know. Now, I'll give you another example that's a little more close to home. When you try to communicate with people who do not understand the operation of the gifts of the Spirit, many of them do not have categories in their head for things like speaking in tongues. If they've never heard of something like that before, then it's a completely foreign thing to them. But if you give them categories into which speaking in tongues will fit, then it will help them to understand because they have something to relate it to. So when I say speaking in tongues and they go, what's that? I say, oh, it's a form of prayer, or it's a form of worship, or it's a form of singing, see, in worship to God. I say, you sing and worship God, don't you? Yes. You pray and talk to God, don't you? Yes. You worship? Yes. Okay. Well, it's like that, only the difference is like this, and explain the difference to them. Then they have a category in their mind that they can relate it to so that they won't be afraid of it. Oh, it's prayer. It's worship. It's singing. Okay? But it's just done a different way. And then you explain how it's different, that the Holy Spirit is giving you the words, and it's coming through your spirit rather than passing through your mind. Okay? Oh. And they might not quite understand that to start with, but at least they won't be afraid if you've related it to some category that they already know exists and is part of their life. You understand? Sometimes we talk about speaking in tongues and it just scares people silly because they don't have any categories, anything to relate it to, and they go, how can this be Christian? How can this be from God? And all they're doing is saying, I don't have a category for it. Okay? And they'll relate to it and think that it's wrong and reject it because we may have been unwise in the way that we communicated it to other people. There are categories into which speaking in tongues fits, and we can communicate it in that way. Okay? Same thing with finances and how God provides for us, or how God speaks to us and gives us guidance. Okay? We can relate that to other people in categories that they understand. Well, have you ever felt that you should do something because you read it in the Bible? Oh, yeah? Okay. They've got a category already that you can relate to. Okay, so when a man is trying to figure out what his relationship is to all of these things, all of these particulars, see, these are the particulars in the universe, when he's trying to understand his relationship to them, he must find a universal category that will cover all of these things in the universe, and then he can understand his relationship to those things, the relationship of those things to each other, and what his significance is in relationship to them. Okay, you understand? Now, we, as Christians, of course, have as the abstraction at the top, we have God. And through that, we can understand, of course, this abstraction is a concrete entity in this case. Philosophical concept, but at the same time, a concrete entity. God, a personal being. That's the wonderful thing about Christianity. But we can understand, for instance, our relationship to a cat. How do you understand your relationship to a cat? Does the existence of a cat threaten your identity? No. Because you understand God made the cat, and God made you, and that's something that you have in common. See, what you're doing is working up the levels of abstraction to where you came from, which is God. Okay? And in your relationship to God, you know that you are different from the cat. You are the same as the cat in that God made both of you. you are different from the cat in that God made you in his image and he didn't make the cat in his image. And so it helps you to understand, but that goes by relating to God. I'm in the image of God, the cat is not in the image of God. See? You have to relate it through God back down to the cat. That happens just like this in your mind. This in your mind. My fingers aren't working today. It's harder when you got chalk on them. It just happens automatically in your mind, and you don't realize that you're doing that. But that's what all people go through to try to figure out their significance or their meaning in relationship to things around them. Now, the humanist who has only his finite mind on which to depend, the humanist is trying to figure out, to extrapolate, if you want to use that word, he is trying to figure out or project out, extrapolate, an infinite universal in his mind. To cover everything in the universe, your abstraction, your category, is going to have to be an infinite one. And if it isn't infinite, it's not going to cover everything in the universe. But here's a problem. Man, with a finite mind, cannot extrapolate an infinite universal. You understand? Man, with his finite mind, is not able to figure out an infinite universal. And if once he thinks he has figured out an infinite universal with his own finite mind, he can never prove that that really is the true universal that covers all things. Because his mind is too limited to be able to prove that. Do you understand? He can only try to take a stab at it. He can never really be sure. Now, Jean-Paul Sartre said this. He's an existentialist. And he said this: no finite point has any significance except in respect to an infinite reference point. See, he saw that very clearly. He said, no finite point has any significance except with respect to an infinite reference point. If all you have are particulars with no infinite reference point to relate the particulars to, then you only have relationships between the particulars, and you can't figure out what the significance of any of those particulars is. See? If we didn't know that there was a God who had made the cat and made me and made us alike in that we were both created by God and different in that I'm in the image of God and the cat is not, then how am I going to understand my relationship with a cat? I can't. I know it's a thing. I know I'm a thing. But maybe it has more significance than I do. See? Who knows? You can't figure that out unless you have an infinite reference point to which you can compare both of those things. And then you're able to compare them to each other. No finite point has any significance except in respect to an infinite reference point. Now, Jean-Paul Sartre was honest with that, and he realized that man with his finite mind could not figure out an infinite reference point to which to compare everything, because the finite mind is too limited to figure out an infinite reference point. And that's why, at some point, man must have revelation from the mind of God, or he is sunk. That is the dilemma of the humanist. At some point, he must receive revelation from a mind greater than his, or he cannot figure out what's going on in the universe, because he can't project an infinite universal that will help him understand all of the particulars in the universe. So he can't even understand his own significance. Beginning to get that? The humanist is sunk because of the finiteness of his mind. And if he does not humble himself to receive revelation from the mind of God, he is sunk, and so are we. If there were no revelation from the mind of God, we would be sunk. If all we had was personal, subjective experience from God, we would still not be able to be sure that we exist, that the experiences that we're having are true and real. We wouldn't be able to be sure. There would always be philosophical doubt about whether or not we exist. We wouldn't be able to figure that out. Things are real. We wouldn't know what is really right and wrong. See? One person could feel from God, well, this is right. Another person could feel, this is right. See? And we wouldn't have any way to say, you're right and you're wrong. Unless we have revelation, objective revelation, from a mind like the mind of God. Yes? No? Yes? Most people will begin to understand it when I start talking about humanism. Now, when you're talking with people on the street, and the person starts talking about knowledge, or they start talking about morals, they start talking about existence, you need to point out to them, or ask them, at least, which system they're working in. Are you saying that we have to try to figure out what is right and wrong by the power of our own finite minds alone? And if they say yes, they're acting as a humanist, see? And if they're acting as a humanist, no, you can't figure out what is right and wrong by yourself, because you can never conclude what is absolute. You can't do that. You can only tell me what you think or what you feel. And that may be different from the next person. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. So here's what we have. The man is trying to figure out an infinite universal, but with his finite mind, he can't do that. You can't figure out an infinite universal with a finite mind. And so he can never figure out for sure what this category is at the top, and so he can never figure out what his real significance, what his meaning is in the universe, and the meaning of other things. Now let's take the picture back to where it was before from the top, and I'll show you the dilemma of philosophy down through the ages has been this, the finiteness of man's mind. Here is the man, here are the particulars in his life, and with his finite mind, he tries to construct a category, an infinite category, what he thinks is infinite, that will cover all of those things so that he can understand his significance in reference to those things. And he goes, aha, I have an infinite category. This is what I think is the infinite category. And that may be everything that exists in the universe, or some infinite impersonal life force, or whatever. Depends on his philosophy. So he thinks that he's got something that helps him understand what's going on in the universe. But there is a problem. There's a very severe problem. And that is that there is more than one person in the world. And so another guy comes along, another philosopher, and he says, well, you know, it's really wonderful that your category covers all of these things in my life, but I have some particulars here that your category, that your universal doesn't cover. Okay? What about these things out here? And this guy says, oops. And so these two get their heads together, very intelligent men, and they try together to construct another universal that will cover all of the things in both of their lives. And they go, aha, we have found an infinite universal that will cover these things. Okay? Well, there's a problem with that. You guess? Yes, there's more than two people. There are more than two people in the world. So this third guy comes along and goes, that's pretty good, guys. You got that much of my life. But there are these things out here, you see. What about that? And these two guys in stereo say, oops. Okay. And then they together, the three of them, construct an infinite, what they think is an infinite universal. Okay? And you know what the problem is? There are more than three people in the world. Okay? And so that's the story of philosophy down through the ages, is that man has, with his mind, tried to figure out what this infinite universal is that will help him understand all things, and with his finite mind, he can't figure it out. That has to happen by revelation from that mind itself, which is the mind of God. If God did not reveal to us that He is the infinite universal, which He's done, He revealed Himself to us in space and time, showed us what He's like, communicated to us in words in the Scripture, and told us what is going on in the universe. And if He had not done that, we would not be able to be sure about anything. See? And so the humanist is sunk because of the finiteness of his mind. He can never figure out what's going on in the universe. And we would be sunk too if we weren't submitting ourselves to the revelation from the mind of God, which is the Scripture. Okay, let me see here what time it is. I'll give you some definitions to some words, and then we'll take a little break. I want to talk about the three... Did you understand this now? Now, see, the wonderful thing about Christianity is that at the top of this level of abstraction, the infinite universal and category that covers everything hallelujah, is not just an abstract philosophical category. It is a personal being to whom we can, with whom we can have relationship. And he wants to have relationship with us. And yet at the same time, philosophically, he answers the questions. Like, why is there personality in the universe? Because God made something like himself. You see? You relate it back to God. God made something like himself. That, so personality should be expected in the universe if God makes anything. You would think, well, he probably makes something like himself. See? Why is there unity and diversity in the physical world? Eh? We'll talk about that under Eastern religion. But why is there unity and diversity in the physical world? Big philosophical problem. Very simple answer. Because God is three and God is one. And God, when he created, made something like himself. Things that are diverse and yet part of one system. You have one tree, but it's got branches and roots, leaves, fruit, flowers. Eh? But it's all tree. Eh? And so God made something like himself. And it makes perfect sense when you understand what's at the top of the line, see? Which is God and his nature and his character. Okay, now I give the definition of three words that we're going to use through the week, the rest of the week. Three words. And that is the three major areas of philosophy and theology. The three major areas of philosophy and theology that you'll always be dealing with when you're talking with people on the streets, the three major areas have to do with three very simple things, but very profound. Being, existence, if you want to say that, has to do with being, choice, and knowledge. How do you know something? And how can you be sure that it's true? How can you verify it? Okay? Being, existence, is very often called the area of metaphysics in science. Metaphysics. The area of choice, we are going to call the area of morals. Not normally called that. Normally, it's called ethics. But the problem that we have today is that, see, the word ethics presupposes that there is right and wrong and that man makes choices. But today, there are a lot of people who are saying man doesn't even make choices because he's an animal, like such as B.F. Skinner. Okay? He will say man is a conditioned being and man doesn't really make choices. He thinks he does, but really what's happening is he's responding to his environment around him. Okay, and of course it depends on different things that you read by Skinner as to what kind of emphasis you get. Depends on what he's talking about. But basically, he still believes man is an animal. Got that? And so there are lots of people who are saying that man has evolved from lower forms of animals, that man is just an animal, and man doesn't make choices. He's a determined being, determined by his environment and by his heredity. And so we will use the word morals because some people don't even agree with the idea of ethics. They don't say that man has choices. Okay, and then knowledge, the area of knowledge, is commonly called the area of epistemology. Episteme in Greek means I come to know. I come to know. It is used, that I know of, it's once in the New Testament. Maybe other places, but I haven't found it. Episteme is used in Acts 19 when the demons, it's used out of the mouth of a demon, Episteme is used in Acts 19 when the demons, it's used out of the mouth of a demon, when a demon says, Jesus I know, and the verb that is used in the Greek is gnosko, which means I am acquainted with, I know him well. Jesus I know, and Paul, and then the verb is from, the verb form is from episteme, I am coming to know. Paul, I am coming to know, but who are you? Jesus I know, Paul I am coming to know. Because they were trying to cast the demon out in the name of Jesus whom Paul preaches. See? And the demon said, Jesus I know, and Paul I'm coming to know, but who are you? And that is from this word, episteme. So, the area of metaphysics has to do with being. The area of morals has to do with choice. The area of epistemology has to do with how do you come to know something. And it also includes the idea of how do you prove that it's true once you know it. How do you come to know it? How do you verify that it's true? How do you show that it's true? How do you prove it? Okay, now let me ask you some questions real briefly about some statements in the Bible. When the Bible says God is a spirit, and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth, God is a spirit. What area does that fall into? What kind of a statement is it? Being. It's talking about God's being. Metaphysics. Okay? How about God is love? It's in the area of morals, the area of choice. That God lives so fully in love and never does anything that is not loving, that the Bible makes the statement about him that God is love. It's a very poetic, graphic way of saying that he doesn't do anything but love. Okay? Called a hyperbole. Okay, so God loves, God is love. By the way, you can't change that around and say love is God, which you'll find a lot of people on the streets doing. If you say God is love, that does not mean, therefore, that love is God. Because God is love means that God is loving, but that's not all there is to God. It's only one of his attributes. So you can't turn around and say, therefore, love is God. So if two people are loving each other, therefore, they must be involved with God. See? No. Okay? God is love. Now let me ask another question. God is light. What does that fall into? We've had one vote for being. Knowledge falls into all of them. We've got to vote for all three. Now, let me ask you, where is that quote from, God is light? What book is it from? First John. And in its context, what is he talking about? He who loves his brother is walking in the light. He who hates his brother is in darkness, even until now. When John uses light and darkness in 1 John, he's talking about morals. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. It means that everything that God does is loving, and he never does anything that is selfish. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. It's a moral statement. And now, with this thought, I'll let you go take a break. What about the statement that Jesus made, I am the way, the truth, and the life? When we start with the idea of naturalism, the idea that the universe is natural causes in a completely closed system, you can draw this. We're going to do a little chart now. You can put that on your paper at the top of a whole piece of paper if you want, because you'll want to write notes, and we'll make a chart. Okay? I'll need to move this over a little bit like this. When we start with the idea of naturalism, completely closed system of natural causes, automatic result of naturalism is humanism. You have to have humanism. Because there is no possibility of revelation from a mind like the mind of God, and so you automatically have humanism when you presuppose naturalism. Automatic result. And then, because we've seen that the humanist, because of the finiteness of his mind, cannot extrapolate, cannot figure out an infinite universal with his mind. And so he has no universal. Now, In order to understand what truth is, a man has to work on the basis of absolutes. But in order to understand what is absolute and what is not, he must have an infinite universal to have a reference point. Otherwise, everything is relative to everything else. Your cats are relative to the chair, relative to the human being. But they're all relative to each other, and unless you have an infinite reference point to relate those two, then you can't really understand what is absolute. What is absolute right and wrong? Absolute existence or non-existence? Absolute knowledge and non-knowledge? You can't figure that out if you don't have the infinite universal. If you don't have the infinite category to refer to, then you can't figure out what is absolute. I'll just try to explain this in different ways. If I, as a human being, as a finite being with no revelation, try to figure out even a very simple thing, such as, okay, Bo, would you stand up, please? What is the color, what is the general color, excluding the black writing, the general color of Bo's t-shirt? Red. Now, but the thing is, how do I know that I am seeing the same thing that you are seeing? I don't. It is relative from one person to the next. And so to say that it is red is only a relative and subjective statement. Thank you, Bo. We can't really say it is absolutely red unless we have some other way of telling besides your feelings and experiences or my feelings and experiences, because they could be very different. I could be seeing something with my eyes that you actually experience as blue, and all I've ever called it is red, so I call it red. But maybe I experience something completely different. Ever thought about that? Never thought about that? What about perception? Well, this may sound a bit strange. What about perception with your eyes? Take your fingers, press on the sides of your eyes, and you've got two different worlds, and they're not in the right place. You go like that, the world switches. It turns, it moves, and it's not in the same place as the actual world is, see? You go like that, and Susie moves, see? She goes around. But actually, Susie is there, is right there. But if I'm a humanist, if I don't have any absolutes to appeal to that Susie is really right there, then I can't tell whether she's real or my perception of her is more real. Got that? Now, don't do that too much with your eyes. It's not good for you. Okay, so with human finite perception, anything that is subjective, now we need some definitions here. Subjective is what happens inside you as the subject. Objective means the thing that is outside of you as the object. Like I as the subject am experiencing this chalk, which is the object. So the chalk is objective to me. My feelings of the chalk, when I look at it, my experiences, my thoughts about the chalk, and my choices towards the chalk are all subjective experiences. They're inside me. Okay? So Neil's thoughts are subjective to him. My thoughts are subjective to me. Or a thought, or a drug trip, or things like that. We call those subjective experiences because they're inside the person. However, Neil's thoughts, relationally speaking, are objective to me. Even though they are subjective in nature, relationally speaking, they are objective to me because they're outside of the realm of my personal experiences. Understand that? So the word can be used both ways. Normally, when I say subjective and objective, I will be referring to the nature rather than relationship. I'll be saying things like a subjective experience. Looking at his shirt and what we think in our minds we see is a subjective experience. Now, anytime something is subjective, it must of necessity be relative. A subjective experience must be relative because you don't know whether or not the next human being experiences exactly the same thing that you do. It is relative to you, relative to your experiences and your thoughts. Now, this is a very important point in many different areas when you're talking with people on the street. If a person starts to speak about things as personal experience, feelings, thoughts, anything that's subjective, you automatically go, aha, then it has to be relative. It can't be absolute. It must be relative because the only way we can say something is absolute is if there is information coming from outside, both you and me, that tells us that it is a certain way. In other words, really, the only way we can establish absolutes is by revelation from God. For instance, do you exist? You can't tell absolutely whether or not you exist. You can only say, I feel, or I think. What if somebody else comes along and says, I don't think you do? I don't feel like you exist. But I feel like it, well, it doesn't make any difference. All it is relative. It's not absolute. See? Or in the area of morals. Most often you have to use extreme examples in morals. One person said to me one time, well, you know, I said, how are you going to know what's good and evil to run a society? He was sort of an anarchist. said, how are you going to know what's good and evil to run a society? And he said, well, we all have a feeling inside that certain things are right and wrong, you know, like, I said, like what? He said, like murder. And I said, oh, Charles Manson didn't think murder was wrong. And he said, well, Charles, he tried to write Charles Manson off. I said, but wait a second. Charles Manson was a member of the society. Charles Manson was a human being. Charles Manson had different subjective feelings from you. How are you going to say that he was wrong? You can only say, I think he was wrong. You can only say, I feel he was wrong. You cannot say absolutely Charles Manson was wrong. And he couldn't. And I said, then you have no absolutes on which to build the morals for a society, and your society can't stand. Because everybody's going to go doing their own thing, and different people will think different things are okay or not okay. Some people will think stealing is okay, some people will think stealing is not. Now, how are you going to have any kind of order when everybody's doing their own thing, and all those things may be different? See? He says, well, we feel inside, we really understand intuitively. I said, well, people have different feelings about what's right and wrong, don't they? Well, yeah, well then how are you going to know absolutely what's right and wrong? We can't. See? I was listening to a guy in Amsterdam that was talking about a community that he lived in. It was based on Eastern religions, a mishmash of Eastern religions. And he said that they didn't believe in absolutes, basically. He didn't use it that way, he used the word relativity. He said they didn't really believe in absolutes. And then later he said they had certain rules at their farm. Things like they couldn't drink. They couldn't smoke cigarettes. They used pot. Couldn't smoke cigarettes. Couldn't commit adultery with somebody else's marriage partner. Okay? They sort of believed in marriage. Sort of. And some kind of loose connection there, commitment. And then later when he opened it up for questions... See, now there's quite a large group of people, probably about twice as many as there are here. And when he opened it up for questions, I said, excuse me, I'd like to ask a question. He said, okay. And I said, you said that you believed that there were no real moral absolutes, and yet you have said that there are rules in your community, that such as not smoking or not committing adultery. Who set up those rules and imposed them on other people if there are no real absolutes? Who did that? And I was absolutely amazed. The guy was not even allowed to answer because the people who were listening started yelling at me. What's the matter? Weren't you listening to him? Yes, that's why I asked the question, because I was listening very carefully, you see. But they all started screaming at me, and just the very mention of absolutes, that there were real moral absolutes, brought this tremendous response from all these people. And I thought, My. People really don't want to have absolutes because then they have to be responsible. See? I knew that what I was doing was touching a very sensitive nerve, that if there are real absolutes, people are really responsible. And boy, they did not want anybody to communicate the idea that there were real absolutes. I didn't say anything about Jesus. Didn't say anything about God. But boy, I sure got a response from the truth. See? And the poor guy couldn't even answer because everybody drowned him out, wouldn't let him talk. So finally he just sort of looked at me and went, no, because everybody's yelling at me, and I thought. So he went on. Okay? But see the problem there? You see what I was pointing out? He says that everything's relative and there aren't any real absolutes, but then they have rules, as if there were absolutes. See? Inconsistency there. And who imposed those absolute rules on other people? You shall not smoke. Who did that if everything's relative? Nobody can say that smoking is wrong, absolutely, for somebody else if everything's relative. You can't say that if it's according to your subjective experience. So if truth is subjective, then truth is also relative. And that's why I just want to give you the logical reasons why that humanists will always say that everything is relative or there are no absolutes. There are no absolutes because everything is subjective. No objective revelation. So they will say there are no absolutes. That is an absolute statement, by the way. The statement that everything is relative is also an absolute statement. And I point that out to them as carefully as I can. Okay. They say everything is relative, and I say, you realize that that is an absolute statement? Are you sure that absolutely everything is relative? And then one guy said, well, maybe not absolutely everything. And I said, good, let's talk about those things that are not relative. Let's talk about the absolutes. Okay? We started talking about the absolutes. Okay? So, and if they say absolutely everything is relative, then I start picking on reality. I say, you mean to say to me, I can't be sure absolutely if you're there or not? Well, no, I guess you can't if there aren't any absolutes. Oh, well, then, you know, I don't see any reason to talk to you. I go sit someplace and wait until they come around. Okay, so there are, that's the kind of person you can wrestle around the room. You know, there are some people you don't do that with. Okay. Now, if there are no absolutes, then you don't have absolute dog and absolute non-dog, like book or chair. See? If there are no absolutes, then there are... Now, we're going to start to get strange here, but that's the way it goes. If there are no absolutes, then there is no absolute dog and absolute non-dog. You can't tell where you stop and the chair starts if there aren't any absolutes. How do you know if you're any different from the chair? Maybe you are one essence together. Maybe everything is one, as they say in Eastern religions. See, this comes very close to Eastern religions. So when the humanist stuck with his own finite mind, has no universal, no infinite universal, so truth is completely subjective. It only can come from within because there's nothing coming from without. No objective revelation of truth and absolutes. So he says there are no absolutes and there are no categories. What was the logo, the sort of the statement that was used for Blow Up, the movie Blow Up? It was love without meaning, murder without guilt. Wasn't that it? Or was it the other way around? Murder without guilt, love without meaning. I think it was murder without meaning, love without guilt. And what is that saying? There are no absolutes. We can't know whether or not there are absolutes, so there are no real categories. So love and murder, you can't really tell whether they're good or evil. You can't say absolutely. So it's love without meaning. You can't say that it's a good thing. You can't say it's significant. You can't say it has meaning. What has meaning? What has non-meaning when there are no absolutes? You can't tell because there are no categories. Murder without guilt. There aren't categories like good and evil, guilt and innocence when there aren't any absolutes. Okay, okay, so you've got no absolutes, so you have no categories, and then you have no opposites. And you should learn this word. Another way of saying opposites in philosophy is antitheses. A thesis is an idea. The antithesis is the opposite. Antithesis. The antithesis is the opposite of the idea. And so when you say there are no antitheses, give me some examples of antitheses. Good and bad. Love and hate. Up and down. Life and death. Existence, non-existence. Eh? Bye, bye. Oh, hello, goodbye. Okay. If there are no absolutes, then there are no real categories. Your categories are lost. And if there are no categories, then there are no opposites. If you don't have real dog and non-dog, then you don't have anything that can be the opposite of something. If you don't have any real good and evil, see? No categories. If you have no real good, you also can't have a real evil. Now, we want to look at how these affect the areas of... Some of you might have a bit of problem here. Try to talk around this. How it affects the areas of metaphysics, morals, and epistemology. How it affects your philosophy and your theology. In the area of metaphysics, now metaphysics has to do with what? Stuff, being, existence. Okay? Metaphysics, existence, being. If you have no absolutes, no categories, and no antitheses, then you do not have a real existence, non-existence system. You can't really say, this really exists, this really does not exist. And so what you get is relativized existence. Not absolute existence, this exists, this does not exist, but relativized existence. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Relativized existence. Now, in modern philosophy, humanist philosophers talk about a debate. And the debate is called the idealism-realism debate. Realism is the idea that things exist on their own. They absolutely, objectively exist whether we experience them or not. So the lecture hall, whether you're experiencing it right now or not, according to a realist, still exists. And as Christians, we have to be realists. We'll look at that in a minute from the Bible. We have to be realists, but realism says that things actually exist. Now, idealism, notice the way I'm writing this. Idealism is actually ideaism. It's different from idealism, like the person is an idealist, they are a communist, that kind of a thing. Ideaism, or idealism, the L is for pronunciation, is the idea that you don't know whether or not things exist because your finite mind is not sufficient to be able to tell absolutely whether or not things really do exist objectively, absolutely. So you have relativized existence. Maybe it only exists as long as you experience it. Maybe that part of the world back there doesn't exist unless I'm experiencing it. If I go like this, maybe Tom Gazzay doesn't exist. Because I'm not experiencing him, see? Right? No, wrong. You do exist, don't you? Okay? So the idea then is that maybe things only exist if you experience them, and you go, but doesn't everybody know that things exist? Well, no, philosophers don't, and a lot of humanists don't, and they'll do this kind of thing with you. Where is the chalk? Okay, it's in my hand, right? Now where is the chalk? Can you prove that? Prove it philosophically, without any kind of personal experience of it. Prove that the chalk is there. And from your subjective, finite viewpoint, you cannot prove that that chalk absolutely, objectively exists up here on the podium. You can't do it. And a lot of philosophers have been very honest with that and said, you can't do it. See? Because, like Immanuel Kant said this, I think it was in the Critique of Pure Reason he said this. He said, a finite mind cannot experience an object from the number of ways and perspectives necessary, which is infinite, cannot experience an object in the number of ways necessary to conclude absolutely that the thing objectively exists. The finite mind cannot perceive an object in the number of ways necessary to conclude that the thing absolutely, objectively exists, apart from your experience. Now, the thing is, the finite mind cannot do that, but God's mind can. And what has happened is, we cannot conclude that things absolutely, objectively exist with our finite minds. But God has revealed to us that things absolutely, objectively exist, whether we experience them or not. How has He done that? Give me a passage of Scripture that says that. Okay, you're thinking, what? Huh? What passage? Genesis 1, okay? It says that God created this on the first day, this on the second day, this on the third day. Man didn't come along with his finite mind until the sixth day. But God, from His infinite perspective, says that things like trees, cows, fish, the earth, water, sun, moon, and stars, that these things exist whether we ever experience them or not. Because God says that they, from His perspective, from His infinite mind, says that they existed before the finite mind of man ever came along. You see that? And so God has revealed to us that things exist whether we experience them or not because He made them to exist that way. And He tells us from His mind, it's not based on my authority. It's based on the authority of an infinite mind. It's not based on my subjective experiences, but on objective truth revealed to us from the mind of God. Okay? And if we didn't have that objective revelation, we would not be able to know. So it is relativized existence, and people say you can't really know if things are real or non-real. The humanist, when you say things are real, he'll say, how do you know? You have to say, on what basis? Humanism? And if he says yes on the basis of humanism, you say you can't know anything on the basis of humanism. We'll get to that in a minute. In the area of morals, you have relativized morality. Okay? We had relativized existence under metaphysics. And with no absolutes, no categories, and no opposites, you have relativized morals. You can't know whether things are right and wrong. There are no real categories such as right and wrong, good and bad. See? And so you have relativized morality, and this is commonly called in philosophy situation ethics. That your morality changes according to the situation that you're in, and you have to try to figure out subjectively what is the loving thing to do in that situation. You have to figure out what is the loving thing to do in that situation. Now, that, of course, was most clearly promoted by Fletcher. And in his book on situation ethics, he says, he gives 9 different definitions for the word love through the book. Some of them are subjective, some of them are objective, and many of them are mutually exclusive of the other definitions. And so we could ask for a little bit of a clearer definition of what love is. But he says that you have to determine from your own subjective experiences, because you don't have any objective way of knowing, because he's ignorant of this thing. You don't have any objective way of knowing what is the real loving thing to do in a situation. You have to figure out from your own subjective feelings of what's good. You have to figure out what's the best thing to do in that situation. Okay? Now, in situation ethics, they will very often present to you what they call a moral dilemma. And that is, they put you in a situation where, imagine situation, where you have to choose to do one thing or the other, and both of them are wrong for you to do, absolutely. You are a Dutch person during the Second World War, and the Germans have occupied Holland. Okay? In the middle of the night, this happens. There's a knock at your door. You open the door, the person with a yellow star and the person on their jacket, and says, "I'm a Jew, will you hide me? The Gestapo are after me." Okay? So you go, okay. So you open the door, you let the person in, and you hide them, and then a few moments later, and you open the door, and it's the Gestapo. And they say, "Are you hiding a Jew in your house?" Do you say no and lie? Or do you say yes and maybe kill somebody? Because you know probably that will happen to them if they're arrested. What do you do? Now, both of those are forbidden to you as a Christian. What do you do? See, now here's where the person in situation ethics says you've got to choose to do one or the other. And the Christian says, uh-uh, I don't have to choose to do one or the other. Because the person in situation ethics is acting as a humanist with only human resources at his disposal. Okay? There's always, with supernaturalism, there's always a third way. There's always the supernatural. You could fling the door open and say, "Come and see." You haven't said yes. You haven't said no. You've invited them to look in your house. And when they walk past, you're praying, "God, you're just going to have to blind their eyes. That's all I can do." And it has happened where people couldn't even see people who were right there because others were praying. And so they were protected. Okay, and if the person does get arrested, then you have to figure out maybe why your prayers weren't answered, or there may have been some other reason why God couldn't justly answer your prayers. Okay, that's a different question. We'll talk about that when we talk about why do the innocent suffer. You'll get principles of how to deal with that kind of question. Okay, but there's always a third way. There's always a third way with the supernaturalists, see? They ask you as a humanist, they ask you to do this or that and to do something wrong. But as a supernaturalist, there is always a third way. I won't go on to that. I won't give any more examples. You understand that? Okay. Now, the third thing is epistemology. Epistemology, the area of knowledge, how we know and how we can know that we know. And in the area of epistemology, if there are no absolutes and there are no categories and there are no antitheses, then there is no absolute knowledge. You get relativized knowledge. So we have relativized existence, relativized morals, relativized knowledge. And no absolute knowledge in the realm of philosophy is called skepticism. And that is why you will meet people who are very philosophically skeptical. It's because they are humanists, and they have no absolutes, and so they must be skeptical. They have to be, because they can't absolutely know something, because they have no revelation on which to base that, no infinite information coming to them from a mind like the mind of God. And so they will constantly, at least very frequently, ask a question like this: how do you know? Knowledge. Epistemological question. How do you know that the Bible is the Word of God? How do you know that Jesus was raised from the dead? How do you know that your sins were really forgiven? Okay. How do you know that miracles can take place? Understand? They'll ask questions like that. How do you know there's a God? They ask questions like that because they cannot know anything absolutely. You can only know things absolutely on the basis of revelation from the mind of God. Because when we have to go by what we subjectively feel, then everything becomes relative. Okay? I think, I feel. And so, when you're talking with them, they will very frequently ask, how do you know? And you need to ask them, well, on the basis of what presupposition would you like me to answer? I did that one time, and the guy, I've been quite surprised. I've had two times that people have done this to me, only twice. I say, on the basis of what presupposition are you asking that question? And the one guy said, well, humanism, of course. And I thought, well, this should be easy to deal with. At least he knows what he's doing. You know? So he said, humanism, of course. And I said, on the basis of humanism, you can know nothing. And he giggled. He thought that was funny. And then we went on talking. See? Because he knew. The reason he giggled was because he knew that that was true. You can't know anything absolutely on the basis of humanism. And then we talked about the dilemma that the humanist has because of his own finite mind. The finiteness of his mind, and that he needs revelation from the mind of God, or he is sunk philosophically. Okay? And being sunk philosophically, of course, will eventually affect the person morally. It's going to affect them as far as their meaning, sense of identity, meaning in life. It's going to affect them personally, too. Okay, now we're going to very briefly go back through this whole thing, only we're going to change it all so that it's not humanist, so it's not from naturalism. You got your little chart, and at the top you've got supernaturalism with the possibility of what? Okay? In supernaturalism, you have the possibility of revelation so that man is not stuck with his own finite mind alone. That's not the only information he can have. He can have revelation from the mind of God. Because there is a God who exists who can communicate. So you have supernaturalism, you have the possibility of revelation, and then you can have an infinite universal, and that universal is God himself, the being of God. There is something at the top, and that is a personal spiritual being that we call God. Then, because of that, your truth is objective, because it's coming from outside of you, from the mind of God. It's objective. So it is no longer relative. It can be absolute. Because it's coming from an infinite mind, and it's coming apart from your experiences. See, this is apart from our experience. Okay? And Peter had heard a verbal, audible word from God on the mountain when he was with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. And he said, we heard this voice when we were with him and he was transfigured. But we have a more sure word of prophecy. And then he goes on to talk about the scripture. See? More sure than an audible voice from God, Peter says. A lot of us would like to hear God speak to us audibly. But you know what Peter the Apostle would say? This is more important than hearing God's audible voice, because this is more sure. Even if you hear him audibly, it's still subjective. Whereas this, being objective, see, is more sure than a subjective experience. And so he calls the scripture a more sure word than hearing God's audible voice. Isn't that interesting? We need to be careful with our desires sometimes. You know, I'd like to hear God speak with an audible voice, but Peter says that's more important. Scripture is more important. Okay? So universal, we have an infinite universal. Truth is objective because it's not according to our personal experiences. It comes from outside of us, from God's mind. It's objective, so it can be absolute. Okay, so there are absolutes. There are categories, real categories. There is real dog and real non-dog. Isn't that wonderful? Okay, there are real antitheses, real opposites. And so, in the area of metaphysics, you have absolute existence and absolute non-existence. Things exist or they don't. Absolute existence, absolute non-existence. In the area of morals, you have absolute morality, real right, real wrong. Okay? Real right and real wrong. And so there are many cases in which we would have questions, but God has said this is right or this is wrong. Okay? Real right, real wrong. And then the third thing is epistemology, the area of knowledge. The area of knowledge that we can know because God has revealed. We can know things absolutely because God has revealed them. If God, from His infinite perspective, with His knowledge, says a certain thing is a certain way, then that's the way it is. And we can say, I know. We can't say, I know on the basis of my own subjective experiences, because that's not true. We can say, I know because of the revelation that God has given to us. So when a person says, how do you know, I usually say, on the basis of my presupposition. My presupposition is that there is a supernatural as well as a natural possibility of revelation, that God actually has revealed, that there are real absolutes. It's not based on my subjective experiences. There are absolutes, there are categories, there are real opposites, and so there's real existence, non-existence, there's real morality, right and wrong, there's real knowledge and non-knowledge, real reality and real illusion. Okay, that's it.